From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The death toll in California continues to rise after a number of fires started over the weekend, burning more than 100,000 acres. The fires are burning north of the San Francisco Bay Area, in and around Santa Rosa and the wine country. Joining us now with more is Brian Watt of KQED. He's in San Francisco. Hi, Brian.
Hello, Jeremy.
And what is the latest on the fire at this point and what's still burning?
Well, the latest numbers that we have is that this fire has killed 9 people in Sonoma and Napa counties, 1 in Mendocino County, and 1 in Yuba County. And authorities are expecting that number to go up. It has displaced at least 20,000 residents, people who had to evacuate their homes. And late last night, there were new evacuations in Santa Rosa, which is the neighborhood that has sustained the most damage. At this point, there is no containment. We've gotten nothing from fire officials that suggest they've gotten a handle on these fires. And so there's a lot of information that people are waiting to hear.
What do we know at this point about how this fire started?
Very little. Investigators are out everywhere trying to figure that out. We know that it started suddenly, very, very much unexpectedly. But because of the wind, it whipped up and there were firewalls as high as 100 feet. And it took a lot of people by surprise, people caught in remote neighborhoods, essentially having to evacuate without necessarily being told to evacuate by authorities.
Now, we were remembering this morning that it's actually been a very wet year in California, a lot of snow in the mountains. It's perhaps surprising that we're seeing such a vicious fire right now.
I don't know how surprised fire officials would be by that, because we have actually had a very, very hot summer in Northern California. And this really is when fire season really, really gets going in earnest in California, is what we're starting to look forward to, crisp temperatures in other parts of the country. But actually, it gets pretty warm.
Right.
And with all of the fuel that grew by all of the water that we got during the winter, that fuel still dried out during the summer with the summer heat, continues to dry out, and it is essentially waiting to be ignited.
Now, you and your colleagues have been hearing from people who had to evacuate their homes. What are you hearing from evacuees?
Well, we're hearing from people who do not know whether their homes have been destroyed or not. We also know that one county got more than 100 missing persons reports, people calling a hotline that the Sonoma County government had set up for people to call and report missing persons. They got more than 100 people missing. And so people are living in a state of uncertainty. I know there are dozens of shelters that were set up across Sonoma and Napa counties. Even one in Marin County, which does not have fire damage, had 400 people. That's 50 miles away from the fire zone. People driving to Marin County, 400 people slept there last night.
Well, and even where you are in San Francisco, you can smell the smoke.
Yes, it's actually gotten palpable here in the KQED studios. That's also a good 50 miles from where the fires are burning. You can smell smoke. The smoke advisory from air officials in the Bay Area was still on here at this hour. Masks are being handed out. I think as early as yesterday morning, I was walking in San Francisco and I started to see people wearing surgical masks to protect themselves from smoke inhalation a full 50 miles from the fire zone.
Well, and when you look at where the fire has hit the hardest, we're hearing about, a hotel being destroyed in Santa Rosa. I saw that the Charles Schulz Museum, Charles Schulz of Peanuts fame, is still okay, but perhaps the family home has been destroyed. A lot of reports of just buildings that are no longer there.
Well, a lot of damage is being done by this fire. There's still a lot being assessed. We have to mention wine country, Napa and Sonoma. The wine associations out there are still waiting to assess the damage. They're not just worried about crops, harvests of this year, but wine casks where wine is aging, perhaps destroyed. This is something that the wine industry expects to cripple them. And if you think about Mendocino County, where, well, there's another W word we're known for out here in California, which is weed, Mendocino
right.
County. So, this is an industry that's kind of waiting to go legit here in California, starting at the first of the year. And they could be losing crops to this fire as well.
That's Brian Watt of KQED in San Francisco with the latest on the fire. Brian, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, today, EPA head Scott Pruitt is expected to formally propose repealing the Clean Power Plan, President Obama's policy to curb greenhouse gas emissions from power plants, by setting emissions targets and forcing utilities to shift away from coal. Pruitt agrees with the states who say the government can only ask utilities to fix plants inside the fence, as it's called, not to ask them to, say, buy wind farms outside the fence. Jennifer DeLohi is with Bloomberg News. Jennifer, the Supreme Court has said the EPA has authority to regulate emissions under the Clean Air Act, which is the underlying law. This is the Clean Power Plan, the regulations. Where are we legally on that?
Right. Well, the Supreme Court also effectively stayed the Clean Power Plan from taking true effect, from states having to meet its burdens, from utilities having to comply with it, pending litigation that is now in the D.C. Circuit Court. So there has been this uncertainty, even though the Supreme Court previously said that the EPA can regulate greenhouse gas emissions from power plants.
Right. And what was the new, most recent court decision? This was just before Justice Scalia died. But what was the recent decision that they were staying it? What was that?
Right. They effectively stayed the rule. They said that this rule will not apply to states. States don't have to worry about complying in the meantime while this litigation is pending in a lower court, because environmentalists obviously are fighting to preserve the law. And meanwhile, you have states, including Scott Pruitt's former state of Oklahoma, challenging the plan. And that litigation is ongoing. It is on hold now as the Trump administration works to rewrite the rule. But again, the Supreme Court has said even the lawsuit, that action needs to be completed before any state is going to be asked to comply.
Right. And it was the Trump administration that asked the lower court to hold off for a minute because there was going to be a new thing to consider. And we're already hearing from states' attorney generals and governors that they are going to sue the administration over this move.
Absolutely. Attorney General Schneiderman from New York made that clear yesterday. Other environmentalists have also indicated that they are prepared to sue to challenge this EPA's decision to either replace it with something very modest, requiring maybe minimal adjustments at individual power plants, or to not replace the Clean Power Plan at all, something that the EPA has said is also a possibility. Needless to say, though, those lawsuits are still quite a ways away. I mean, we have to get through a significant amount of rulemaking and federal bureaucracy in Washington, D.C. before really those court challenges can come to pass.
Well, so as you're indicating, many states already have their own stricter standards. Some say the market is already going more towards renewable energies as, you know, industry sees that in the future. But what does this mean in the now?
Well, what the Clean Power Plan did on some level was kind of codify in federal law, enshrine in federal law this notion that, or this market trend that was already occurring, where you did see utilities increasingly turning to natural gas and turning to wind and solar power because it is increasingly cheaper than coal, a dirtier burning source of electricity. So to some degree, the regulation enshrined that market trend already happening, but it also kind of capped the upside for coal. So had there been or were there to be a significant drop in coal prices and a real big increase in natural gas prices over the next few years, it would have acted to reduce the likelihood of utilities suddenly turning on a bunch of mothballed coal plants or, you know, bringing more coal power back into the mix.
Yeah. Well, meantime, the Trump administration has nominated Andrew Wheeler, a prominent coal lobbyist, to be deputy administrator of the EPA. Also, the New York Times recently calculated that the Trump administration has sought to reverse more than 50 environmental rules so far, everything from repealing a ban on offshore oil and gas drilling in the Atlantic and Arctic to revoking Obama-era flood standards for federal infrastructure projects. This is probably one agency in the government that is accomplishing things.
Absolutely. I think Scott Pruitt, the administrator of the EPA, would tell you that they're returning, as he would say, to regular order and making this very dramatic reversal. They're doing so with a relatively thin staff, but that staff is largely compromised by people who have worked for many years on these very same issues. In some cases, like Andrew Wheeler, who has yet to be confirmed to the EPA's number two spot, people who have lobbied on these issues aggressively in recent years.
Now, and what is the sense, do you know, within the agency? We were reading reports recently that Scott Pruitt ordered a soundproof booth, like you see in hearing testing places, Dewey put in his office for fear of, I don't know what. I mean, what's your sense of the agency?
Well, you know, I think Scott Pruitt is a different administrator than we've had in recent years, even under the previous Bush administration, in that he came from Oklahoma. He, of course, had a long history challenging EPA. And, you know, I think there are folks around him, and he is probably acutely aware of the concern among some senior staff, or some staff, rather, at EPA, some of the people who have spent their years working at the EPA to, you know, safeguard the human health and to safeguard the environment, and maybe skeptical of some of the decisions he is making. So I think there is a concern among him and some of his top advisors about, you know, being able to make those calls at the top without worrying about being undermined within the agency.
Jennifer DeLohi of Bloomberg News. Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you.
In a brief press White House appearance today with Henry Kissinger, President Trump was asked to respond to Senator Bob Corker's claim that he was putting the country on the path to World War III. The president said, "We were on the wrong path before." The president and his former ally have been in a Twitter war after President Trump tweeted that Corker only decided not to run for re-election after Trump refused to endorse him. Corker then tweeted that the White House was an adult daycare center. And in his New York Times interview, he said the president's staff struggles every day to try to contain him. Trump tweeted today, "The failing New York Times set little Bob Corker up by recording his conversation, was made to sound a fool, and that's what I am dealing with." Is there historical precedent for what we're seeing now, not just with Corker, but the president's tiff with his Secretary of State? For that matter, his wives' war of words over who is the first wife. Let's bring in Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a CNN political analyst. He joins us from Princeton. Julian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And start with the Corker back and forth. This is a former ally. The president needs his vote. Corker is saying to fellow Republicans in that New York Times interview, "Say in public what you're saying in private." Have you seen this before?
No, it's remarkable. There are moments, obviously, when presidents are in heated battles with legislators from the same party. So one example is in the 1960s, Lyndon Johnson and Senator Fulbright were really at odds over the war in Vietnam, and Fulbright conducted hearings to expose the problems with the war. Speaker Tip O'Neill, a Democrat, was often saying bad things about Jimmy Carter. But here it's different. I mean, Senator Corker is really questioning his fitness and really whether he can be president. And he's raising questions about the way he conducts himself, the kind of person he is. So it's a whole other level of public criticism from an ally, from someone in the same party, that's very different than what we've seen before. And it's pretty stunning to hear him say it, not just once, but over the course of several days, almost giving the country a warning from the Hill.
Well, what about post-Nixon? I mean, we're all watching the Vietnam War series about the Vietnam era. And, you know, when the tapes started to come out, when it was clear that there was perhaps, you know, drinking involved, I mean, weren't people stepping up then?
Well, they would at the very end. I mean, that's the culmination, and that's why the tapes were so damning. Again, even in that case, though, the tapes ended up being more about listening to what President Nixon was doing in terms of obstructing an investigation rather than when transcripts were released of the tapes and we saw he cursed all the time and he said anti-Semitic things. That part is what we're talking about now, but it's not simply President Trump's language. I think Senator Corker's pointing to something very different. Can we trust him to have this position? And is he even capable of having this much authority with regard to military power and other matters?
Talk about Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who had lunch at the White House today with the president. Before that, the president was asked if he had undercut Tillerson with some of his comments. Let's listen.
No, I didn't undercut anybody. I don't believe in undercutting people. Thank you very much, everybody.
Well, but then there was also that reporting that Tillerson had in anger called the president a moron. The president tweeted out something about, he's called me a moron. We should compare our IQs. You know, it's okay. It's maybe sharper because it's social media, but is there another time in history like the fireside chats where a president went directly to the public that this is analogous to?
Well, again, we have to separate the fact presidents often have gone to the public in different ways, whether it was the fireside chats, Franklin Roosevelt speaking in the radio or Reagan using television, from what we're seeing now. This is not simply opening the lines of communication. This is the kind of communication that President Trump is using. He is going into open battle with his allies, with his own cabinet, whether it's talking about IQ tests or openly undercutting Secretary of State Tillerson. There's no doubt he's done that repeatedly at this point, yeah. Despite what he says. So the substance of his communication is really, I think, what's taking people aback, including people who supported him until now, who still support him, but are not quite sure what to do with the kind of rhetoric right. or the kind of tweets coming from this president.
Well, I misspoke. It was in a Forbes magazine story out yep. today that he yep. said that about if Tillerson did say he was a moron, then let's compare IQ tests. Look, you wrote on CNN.com that Tillerson should quit. Why?
Well, the argument is many people are complaining now, including Senator Corker, or issuing warnings that we have a problem, but not many people have done anything. And so, you know, one argument is Secretary Tillerson, if he sees a big problem and he's really at odds with the president, he should stay in and work from within to make sure things are as good as possible. But the other is to do something to shake the political status quo. And that's exactly what a resignation would do. And it could have a big effect on the Hill. It could trigger some kind of activity or response rather than simply statements that could be a problem, that could be significant. You know, often members of cabinets stay in the cabinet because they believe they can do better work from inside than outside. But often that doesn't turn out to be the case. And so that's why I wrote the piece.
Well, look, I just want to get to the Donald Trump's wives issue. Ex-wife Ivana on Good Morning America talked about her relationship with her ex-husband.
I have the direct number to White House, but I don't really want to call him there because Melania is there, and I don't want to cause any kind of jealousy or something like that because I'm basically first Trump wife, okay? I'm first lady, okay?
Okay, she's laughing. She's joking. Melania's office didn't take it that way. They said these were self-serving noise. This was self-serving noise. We only have a couple seconds here, Julian. Uncharted territory?
Absolutely, and not a surprise. This is the kind of personal and political chaos that President Trump has brought to office. So the family's quarrels spilling out into the public is what we should expect, and yeah. it is different than what we've seen.
Princeton University's Julian Zelitzer, thank you as always for the historical perspective.
Thanks for having me.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, HIV is spreading among gay Hispanic men, particularly those under the age of 30. Researchers say young Hispanics are acquiring the virus that causes AIDS at greater rates than other groups, putting them on the leading edge of transmission. Stigma about homosexuality in the Hispanic community may be part of the problem. Wendy Rigby from Texas Public Radio reports from San Antonio.
For Joey Garcia, life as a gay teenager in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas was never easy.
I was 13 years old when I revealed it to my parents that I was gay. They actually kicked me out of the house.
And it wasn't just his family. Garcia says his lifestyle was often frowned upon by people in the traditional, sometimes macho, often religious Hispanic community.
There's definitely a lot of stigma. I see it all the time.
Garcia's 24 now. 4 years ago, he went to a pride event in San Antonio. They offered free HIV tests, and so he got one. He'd done it before, and he didn't think he had anything to worry about. When the results were positive, he was stunned.
I ended up not practicing safe sex with one of my partners who was apparently cheating on me at the time. I was in shock for a little bit. I didn't really know what to say.
Texas, along with California and Florida, has the highest number of new HIV cases in the country, with more than 4,400 new cases in each of those states in the last reporting year, which was 2015. And, says infectious disease Dr. Barbara Taylor of UT Health San Antonio, young Hispanic gay patients have it particularly rough.
You are stigmatized because you are a minority. You might be stigmatized because you're gay. And then you're stigmatized again because you're living with HIV.
Taylor says Garcia's part of a new generation of HIV patients, young Hispanic men showing up in HIV clinics in alarming numbers. While overall rates of new HIV cases in the U.S. are on the decline, genetically linked cases are showing up in clusters, meaning groups of people are being infected with similar strains of the virus. The CDC has identified 16 clusters in Texas and is monitoring dozens of HIV clusters around the country. That information provides a starting point for intervention, including wider use of the prescription HIV prevention drug known as PrEP or Truvada for people at high risk.
I think it's a game changer. In places in the South and in Texas, I think this could dramatically change what we see.
That's Philip Schnars, a kinesiology, health, and nutrition professor at the University of Texas at San Antonio. He's a vocal advocate for increased access to PrEP and says the daily pill isn't often prescribed in certain parts of the country. The idea of an HIV prevention drug rankles some people who contend using it encourages risky sexual behavior. As a gay man himself, Schnars disagrees.
It is cheaper to prevent it than to actually treat it, right? So that's good for everybody. There shouldn't be stigma around this. This is something that you're doing that's going to protect you, and that's a good thing.
More than a million people in the U.S. are living with HIV. With the right medications, they don't infect others and can lead long lives. But Dr. Barbara Taylor says without a cultural shift and broader access to testing and care, nothing will change anytime soon.
We have the tools to prevent HIV. We just have to get them to the right people at the right times. From my perspective as an infectious disease doctor, new infections are a failure on our part. If we could put everybody diagnosed with HIV on treatment, we would stop the HIV epidemic in its tracks.
Hispanics are disproportionately affected by HIV. They make up 17% of the U.S. population, but 25% of all new cases of the virus, a disturbing increase in infections. For Here and Now, I'm Wendy Rigby.
Here in Boston, fans expect a lot from their teams and a lot from the reporters who cover them. I'm Boston Globe sports columnist Chris Gasper. I'm working with WBUR to bring you a new daily podcast, Season Ticket. I'll take fans with me for a behind-the-scenes look from the press box to the locker room and beyond. Season Ticket, available at WBUR.org/seasonticket or wherever you get your podcasts. Funding provided by Zip, the smartest way to hire.
The endangered black-footed ferret became nearly extinct more than three decades ago. The species is related to the weasel family, and it's an important part of the ecosystem as the animals are both predators and prey. Well, now, a captive breeding program in northern Colorado is helping bring back the black-footed ferret. Grace Hood of Colorado Public Radio has more.
Most black-footed ferrets that live in the wild in Colorado begin their lives here, inside a nondescript building north of Fort Collins. U.S. Fish and Wildlife biologist Robin Bortner wends her way through a maze of metal cages. Inside every cage is a black-footed ferret. Each one has a name. There's the Fonz, Captain Crunch,
Mrs. Doubtfire.
And you'll notice he's a male. Someone was feeling very clever that year.
Bortner opens a dark box that holds a female ferret. She's a mom and has several young ferrets called kids.
Usually she has some choice words about us checking in on her.
That's in part because we woke her up. Black-footed ferrets sleep underground about 20 hours a day. At night, they eat prairie dogs and take over their underground burrows. Captive ferrets need to learn these critical skills.
And so what you're seeing here is kind of a boot camp, really.
Wildlife biologist John Hughes walks outside past one of 40 tall pens. There are mesh covers on top. Walls go 6 feet deep underground to prevent escapes. At 3 months, young ferrets enter one of these pens for what's called preconditioning.
And I have not seen a single ferret out here.
That's actually good because, we say around here, they're acting like ferrets. They're being active at night and not active during the day.
In other words, napping during the day and hunting at night.
Ferrets here need to kill two live prairie dogs before they're released into the wild. Last night, biologists released the dogs into several of the pens. Hughes stops to compare notes with wildlife biologist Tyler Trenton about one of the ferrets.
He obviously appears to be wanting us to bring him food rather than killing his own, so...
Oh, he's been out here well over a month by now, because he was out for that first release.
They decide that this ferret isn't equipped for release outdoors.
If he's been out here this long, he's not going to all of a sudden have an epiphany. So.
I don't think so.
The animal will live the rest of his days inside a zoo or live museum display. It can take up to $6,000 to raise a single ferret. Hughes says setbacks in this work are common. Habitat loss and disease are the biggest threats to the species. Back in 2006, there were more than 1,500 ferrets living in the wild across the United States. A form of plague brought that number down to about 300.
You know, it shows you the dramatic impacts plague has on ferret recovery.
A new oral vaccine is showing promise. Scientists are figuring out the best way to deliver it. Trenton and Hughes moved to another pen to check in on a ferret named Plantain. She also got a live prairie dog last night.
It's probably down in here.
Trenton opens a wooden door to an underground burrow. He pulls up some of the insulation designed to mimic the ceiling of the den.
It still looks pretty
cool. There's the ferret. Yeah, so she got it last night. And she'll just munch on it for the next couple days.
This is the second confirmed kill for the ferret. That means she'll be released to one of 24 sites this fall. For Here and Now, I'm Grace Hood.
There's a new documentary premiering this Friday that looks at how much food we waste. It's a lot. One-third of all the food produced each year for human consumption is never eaten. That's about 1.3 billion tons of food waste every year. Here's a clip from the documentary where Chef Dan Barber says one way to help solve this problem is to come up with recipes that turn food waste into popular dishes, like bouillabaisse.
Fishermen's wives took the damaged and unsellable fish, and they created a big stew of all this reject fish and called it a bouillabaisse, prosciutto di Parma. That pig is a waste-fed pig, but you don't call it waste pork. That's why these dishes become so important, because they're not sold as waste. They're sold as what they are, which is delicious dishes.
The documentary is called Wasted, The Story of Food Waste, and it's hosted by chef, author, and CNN personality Anthony Bourdain, who joins us now. Anthony Bourdain, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, you say in the beginning of this film that you are not an advocate. So how did you come around to doing this?
Yeah, I don't like the idea of being an advocate. I don't like to be certain of anything or present myself as certain of anything or adhering to any orthodox view on anything. I'm a doubter by nature, but this is an area, this is an issue that goes fundamentally against my instincts as a long-time working cook and chef, where we were taught from the very beginning that one just does not and cannot and must not waste food. And I heard of the project. They pitched it at me. And at first I was like, oh, man, I'm really not the right guy for this. I don't want to make something that's preachy, or I don't want to do that. But the more I thought about it, not just my experiences as a chef and how it goes against everything I believe on a cellular level, but I thought about all of the people that I have seen and come to know over the last 17 years traveling around the world and eating, and how people struggle for food every day in so many of the places I go, and how much they make with so little, very proudly and generously, and how delicious food can be even in places where they have so little to work with, and how important those principles and techniques are to even the classic French gastronomy and Italian gastronomy that I grew up with and love. So that really got me and informed my decision to jump into this thing with both feet.
Well, one of the amazing statistics in this film is that more than 90% of our food waste in the U.S. goes into a landfill.
Yeah, I mean, it's a grotesque, particularly, and it's willfully wasted in many cases, and needlessly or negligently wasted in others.
So what can people do when they watch this? I was wondering, can I do anything, or is this something that the big, you know, food industry, the companies are going to have to do in order to stop throwing away so much perfectly good food?
Well, I think we can, you know, it begins in a sense with how do we value the things we eat? You know, it begins with just starting to pay attention to how much food you're buying, how much you were actually using, what you were doing with it. Simply by thinking about your home cooking in a way that professional chefs think about restaurant food, meaning, you know, when you order food for the evening, because profit margins are so narrow in the restaurant business, the chef has always had to think, what happens if I don't sell all the chicken? What will I do with the leftovers? How will I make something delicious that I can sell that people will want and desire the next day? If you think about food when you shop in that way, if you think also about all of the parts of proteins and vegetables that we don't currently use that are in fact quite delicious, in many cases more delicious than the things we attach artificial value to, that's a start. And then demand more of our retailers. You know, it is shocking that, you know, we expect of our chain supermarkets that they have these towers of perfect-looking, highly perishable produce there. You know, they put a lot of that produce on the shelf deliberately to look abundant and for no other reason. They know that in order to maintain this look of abundance, this appearance of endless abundance, that they're going to have to throw out a significant portion of that. We don't need that. We shouldn't want it and we shouldn't tolerate it.
When it comes, though, to eating all the parts of the animal, there are a lot of Americans mm-hmm. who, you know, they're given pig's feet or chicken feet or something like that. That's not going to be something that they're going to want to eat. Do we have to get
We are already getting past that as a nation. I mean, foods that we never valued even 20 years ago are now the dishes of the moment. I mean, I remember when I started cooking in the early 70s, bluefin tuna would be sold for cat food. Octopus was a garbage fish, a trash fish. Beef cheeks, you know, these things were considered pork belly. These are hot menu items now. In many cases, in order to eat the food, the ingredients, and the traditional dishes that the poor used to have to eat in this country, you have to go to a hipster restaurant in Brooklyn and pay $32 right. for a plate. So this is not that much of a stretch. It's really a matter of marketing and inspiring people. And in a lot of ways, it's up to chefs and food leaders to convince people with a beautiful and delicious argument that this is what food can be. So many of the dishes we take for granted and love, we don't realize that these dishes originated, these recipes like pot-au-feu, coq au vin, escargot, the classic Italian Sunday gravy, you know, the red sauce ragu. These were dishes invented in incredibly hard conditions in rural communities where people had very, very little and were essentially solving difficult problems with creative solutions.
I want to ask you about something that is pointed out in this film, which is one American chef goes to a farm in Japan where they feed their pigs a special blend of leftovers instead of corn or soy. And he says, oh, this is the most delicious pork I've ever tasted.
Yeah. All the hotshot chefs want what are basically boutique pigs now. They want pigs with a specific, carefully managed flavor profile and textural profile. On the high end, a pig that is, you know, fed nothing but acorns in Spain, like the Spanish Iberico ham, that would be one rather luxurious example. But what the Japanese are doing is separating out edible waste and making pig food out of them, specifically to give particular pigs particular flavor profiles, and the Japanese are really enjoying this and willing to pay more rather than less. And, you know, this points up one of many creative, you know, possible solutions or at least mitigating factors in this terrible problem we have.
But we're not doing that in the United States, really, right? Most of our livestock are eating corn and grains.
We are certainly paying a lot more attention on what our animals eat and what conditions they are raised. So it's not much of a stretch to see that as a possible future.
Do you expect that at some point we'll have laws in this country regulating food waste the way that there are in other countries?
Like in South Korea, where you are taxed or basically penalized, you know, they monitor how much usable waste you're generating from your home, and you get a bill at the end of the month if you're being particularly wasteful. you know, animal protein, particularly fish and, you know, beef, I don't think these are ever going to get less expensive or particularly more plentiful. So it is inevitable if we don't get our act together that sooner or later, in the face of dwindling resources and supplies, that there will be some sort of regulation. And that's fundamentally something that Americans hate, understandably. But, you know, hopefully we'll never reach that point. You know, the way forward here is to eat better, you know, more delicious food, to enjoy cooking it and eating it more, not chaw away mindlessly at, you know, this endless supply, seemingly endless supply of flavorless abundance.
It seems like another part of the answer here is just to get people to understand exactly what they're eating, to know where the food is coming from. And you focus in this on a school in New Orleans where the kids, you know, as is the case with Alice Waters' school out in California, where they mm-hmm. actually have to grow their own vegetables. They have to understand how it all works. But I wonder whether you think that that is something that could be replicated around the country. I just think of Michelle Obama having the garden in the White House, and there were people making fun of that, you know, that she was doing that.
Yeah, well, look, I think, you know, I have noticed in my travels, I think anyone who works in a farming community, anyone who lives close to the or is involved in the production of food, whether they're fishing, farming, raising beef, whatever, they're less likely to waste because they've seen it up close, how much work goes into it, what's involved. So I think even limited experience as a child, seeing where food comes from and what's involved, this is surely a good thing.
That's Anthony Bourdain, the chef and CNN host and the host of the new documentary, Wasted, The Story of Food Waste. Anthony Bourdain, thank you.
Thank you. It was fun.
And the film comes out on Friday. We've got more details and a trailer at hereandnow.org.
Facebook and Twitter have acknowledged finding Russia-connected ads placed during the last election. Yesterday came reports that Google, which includes YouTube, Gmail, and Google Search, also found evidence of Russian agents purchasing thousands of dollars of ads to spread disinformation and interfere with the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Google, Facebook, Twitter are all set to testify before Congress at the beginning of next month. All got criticism for not seeing the Russia-linked campaigns earlier. So where are we on Russian influence through American social media? Let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kurt Wagner is senior editor of social media for Recode. He joins us from San Francisco. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Robin.
So last month, Google said there was no evidence of interference from the Russians. Now Google's found it. We haven't seen the ads, but what do they entail? And what do you think about this discovering what apparently was there?
Well, a lot of these companies are doing internal investigations right now to figure out exactly how, far along Russian sources were able to push ads and other content to all of those users. So, you know, 6 months ago, these companies weren't even really aware that any of this had happened. And now they're kind of grappling with the fact that their mm-hmm. services were kind of weaponized in this way. And so the plan up until now for most of them has been to say, well, we don't know anything that's going on. We're doing an internal investigation. And now it is slowly starting to come to light exactly how bad this was. So that's what we saw with Google. Facebook and Twitter had both previously acknowledged that there were ads and other posts shared on their site as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great phrase you use. The web has been weaponized by the Russians. You write, they would often take both sides of an issue. I mean, I said we haven't seen the ads, but the Russians would take, let's say, both sides of the Black Lives Matter issue or the gun control issue just to gin all voters up?
I think the effort was to create a lot of, you know, discontent and a lot of animosity among voters. And I think in some ways probably encouraged some people not to vote at all, right? If they mm-hmm. continually went online and saw this, you know, rhetoric and saw friends, especially on social media, if they saw friends who had different viewpoints and were getting fired up over that kind of stuff, maybe they would just sit out altogether from the conversation. And so I think more than anything, it was just an effort to really get at Americans who were, you know, very passionate about certain issues and kind of stoke that passion in all the wrong ways.
Yeah. Microsoft is also reviewing its sales records for ads during the campaign. Is it illegal for Russians to purchase these ads and for tech companies to accept the money?
Well, it is illegal for a foreign government to try and influence or sway a U.S. election. I think the challenge right now is, you know, A, how much was known at the time? I don't believe there was much known by a lot of these companies. They sell all of these ads with what are called self-serving ad platforms, so people can go in and buy them without ever having to talk to an employee of Facebook, for example. And I think the backlash is going to be less about a formal punishment for a crime necessarily, but more about regulation and saying, hey, clearly this is a system without the appropriate oversight. How can we make sure that when people buy political ads on a Facebook or Google in the future, not only is everyone at the company going to be aware of what's being purchased, but how can the government also track and make sure that someone who's not supposed to be buying ads is not buying the ads?
Well, will that apply to Americans undercover as well? I mean, the call has been for transparency. Will that apply across the board? On Sunday, 60 Minutes aired an interview with the Trump campaign's digital director, Brad Parscale, who said he had partisan Facebook employees work as what he called embeds in the campaign. What did he mean?
Well, these big platforms often provide some kind of, you know, employee support for big political campaigns, and that is what happened with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and other politicians for that matter, right? And it's not a secret that they want these politicians to be using the platform, to be posting regularly. They want their campaign to be spending money. So they send employees to go help out and kind of teach them how to use a Facebook or a Twitter. I think what's ruffling a lot of people's feathers is this idea that, Brad said, hey, we were able to pick people who were Trump supporters and really come out and kind of take advantage of a Facebook versus simply learning about how Facebook works. Facebook, of course, has said that's not the case. But I think there's a lot of people that don't understand that in the background, a lot of these tech companies are actually helping both sides to try and better understand how to use that platform and get their voices more widespread.
Yeah. That's Kurt Wagner, senior editor for social media for Recode. We have just a few seconds here, Kurt, but what do you expect to happen when these companies, Facebook, Google, Twitter, go before Congress?
Well, I think that we are going to see a lot tighter regulations moving forward. I think that everyone's already started to hint at that, and I think in the future, anyone who buys ads are going to have to be a lot more public about it.
Boy, the word regulations with the word internet. it was a no-no a while back. We'll see what happens. Kurt, thank you.
Thank you.
Again, senior editor of social media for Recode. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.